Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition. Maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 3rd of December, these are our main stories. An American woman who says she was brought to Britain at the age of 17 and made to have sex with Prince Andrew has told the BBC she's standing by her story. Around 50 presidents and prime ministers are taking part in 2 weeks of UN climate talks in Madrid amid a growing sense of crisis. And there's a changing of the guard in Brussels as Ursula von der Leyen takes over from Jean-Claude Juncker as president of the European Commission. Also in this podcast, we go to Zimbabwe.
Sometimes we just sit and talk. We don't have food to eat. Sometimes we just sleep without eating. The future is not good at all.
How the country is struggling to emerge from the shadow of its former president, Robert Mugabe. Just a few weeks ago, a BBC interview with Queen Elizabeth's son, Prince Andrew, made headlines around the world. Well, shortly before we recorded this podcast, a new BBC interview with American Virginia Jeffrey about her allegations against Prince Andrew aired here in the UK. When she was a teenager, then known as Virginia Roberts, she says she was trafficked to London and made to have sex with the prince as part of an abuse ring controlled by the now deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In the documentary, Miss Jeffrey alleges that she was brought to a property in the US as part of a job interview to be a masseuse after being approached by Mr. Epstein and his girlfriend Ghislaine Maxwell. She says she told them that she'd had a history of physical and sexual abuse, and that started her on a path which she alleges led her to being abused by the prince in London.
It was a wicked time in my life. It was a really scary time in my life. I had just been abused by a member of a royal family. So when you talk about these chains, you know, yeah, I wasn't chained to a sink, but these powerful people were my chains. I didn't know what could happen. And I couldn't comprehend how in the highest levels of the government and powerful people were allowing this to happen, not only allowing it to happen, but participating in it.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond, told me more.
Well, I think we expected to get new revelations, Emilio, from the interview with Virginia Jeffrey. But in fact, the real revelation wasn't in that interview, emotional and detailed though it was. It was that Panorama said that it had learnt that five women have said in legal proceedings in the US that Prince Andrew was witness to them giving massages to Jeffrey Epstein and his guests in the businessman's home. And that appears to contradict what the prince said. He said he'd not witnessed any behaviour of the sort that subsequently led to Epstein's arrest and conviction. And there's more bad news for the prince, because Panorama says that subpoenas, legally enforceable demands for sworn testimony, have been prepared for Prince Andrew if he sets foot on US soil. Now, they're not a done deal. He could challenge them in court, but obviously he would risk losing and would then become embroiled in the US legal system, which is almost certainly a place he does not want to be.
That would be absolutely extraordinary. Now, back to the interview. You said it yourself, there's pretty detailed accounts there.
Yeah, it was pretty grisly listening at times and watching too. You know, at one point, Miss Jeffrey welled up, in fact, broke down in tears. At another, she was describing in pretty vivid detail she and Prince Andrew dancing in a club, quite how much he sweated, which is another bone of contention between her version of his life and his version of his life. And also about what happened in March 2001 when she says she slept with him, something that he categorically denies. And what is pretty clear is it's dissolved now, this situation, into a kind of he said, she said. And if the palace thought or hoped that this would go away with Prince Andrew's withdrawal from public duties, it simply hasn't. And in fact, with these new revelations and with the very painful interview that Ms. Giuffre gave, I think the controversy has just grown.
Johnny Diamond, now to Zimbabwe, a country that was defined for so many years by Robert Mugabe and the independence struggle. He's gone, but the country is struggling to emerge from his shadow, and for many Zimbabweans, life has not improved under his successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Earlier this year, there were widespread protests after the government increased the price of fuel. Human rights organizations in the country say 12 people were killed. Fuel queues, food shortages, and the lack of electricity are a fact of life for many. Stephen Sacker reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Mbari, a sprawling slum on the outskirts of Harare. It's where Zimbabweans come to escape crushing rural poverty. But many find themselves in a different sort of trap.
Things are getting worse and worse every day. Prices are going for transport, schools, clinics are closed, everything is down. We are struggling.
And do you have children?
Yeah, and they are not going to school. I can't afford to pay school fees for them.
A crowd gathers around a stall selling basic provisions. When I ask them whether life has improved under the successor to Robert Mugabe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, their answer is unanimous.
No!
The chronically sick are being sent home from one of Harare's biggest hospitals. Almost all the doctors are refusing to work. Tapiwa Mungofa had initially been proud to qualify as a medic, but not now.
People are dying avoidable deaths because of the current situation, and the healthcare system in Zimbabwe has collapsed. There is no healthcare system to talk about.
But the government would say that is on your conscience.
Yes, but it's not on our conscience, because I cannot use my conscience to pay for my bills. I cannot use my conscience to pay for transport. I am just an ordinary employee like any other employee, and I need to be capacitated for me to do my job.
The Zimbabwean government fears as many as 7.5 million people will need emergency food aid next year. The Environment Minister, Mangaliso Ndlovu, blames continued sanctions and the impact of Zimbabwe's prolonged drought.
When we talk of people going hungry, we are literally talking about food on the table. And food on the table, there is a direct impact coming from the drought that we have experienced. And this has stretched, if I may say, government social protection expenditure, because we have had to import close to 70% of our grain just to make sure that there's adequate grain in the country.
Under Mugabe, hyperinflation meant the US dollar became the de facto currency. Now there's an effort to reintroduce the Zimbabwean dollar, but only in limited amounts. And people tell me that they can withdraw barely enough to last a single day. One woman I met was prepared to give President Mnangagwa a chance.
Yes, I'm confident.
You are?
Yes.
Because many people here are not. Why are you
me,
so
confident? I'm very, very confident.
At sunset in Mbari, the mood shifts quickly. The entire neighbourhood is plunged into darkness. The electricity grid has been crippled by a lack of hydroelectric power.
This one is my sister's child, my big sister's child.
Down a maze of dark alleys, in a block originally built for single male labourers, but now teeming with families, I meet Yvonne Mugombe. She and three generations of her family live in one room, and after dark, they huddle together by candlelight.
Sometimes we just sit and talk. We don't have food to eat. Sometimes we just sleep without eating.
What do you think the future is going to be for your family?
The future is not good at all, because there is no one going to school. There is no one who's got a job. We just sit, we just wait for people to help us to find food to eat. We ask for people to help us.
Yvonne Mugombe ending that report from Stephen Sacker. Today marks the changing of the guard in Brussels, where the new president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, takes over from Jean-Claude Juncker. Her team will be 27 strong instead of 28 because the UK has decided not to nominate a commissioner as the government prepares for Brexit. Here's our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly.
This changing of the guard in Brussels is likely to mean a changing of styles at the top, too, with the avuncular eccentricity of Jean-Claude Juncker giving way to the more conventional approach of Ursula von der Leyen. Brexit has diminished the Commission numerically. It will sit with no British representative for the first time since the early 1970s. Legal action against the UK is threatened as a consequence. But Ms. von der Leyen will hope that her team also proves noteworthy for other reasons. It is the most gender-balanced commission ever, consisting of 12 women alongside 15 men, and probably has the broadest spread of ages, too. Lithuania's commissioner is under 30, Spain's over 70. There's also an ambition for the EU to show global leadership on the climate crisis. A plan is promised within 100 days. But it's likely the commission's proceedings will come to be dominated first by Brexit and eventually by budgetary issues, as wealthy countries seek to head off plans to force them to fill the financial hole that Brexit will leave.
Kevin Connolly. A staggering figure of about 1 million people take their own lives every year around the world. It's also the second biggest cause of death among young people. Now scientists have identified parts of the brain that appear to be linked to an increased chance of suicide, potentially offering a way to identify those at risk. With more, here's Richard Hamilton.
The scientists from the universities of Texas, Yale, Melbourne and Cambridge looked at 131 previous studies which examined more than 12,000 people. Their research suggests that alterations in two parts of the brain involved with decision-making and emotion can lead to a higher risk of suicidal thoughts. Dr. Anne-Laura van Harmelen from the Department of Psychiatry at Cambridge University is one of the co-authors of the report.
We found, for one, that a network that is involved in excessive negative thinking about yourself may be really important for suicidal ideation or thinking about suicidal actions. And then we found another network that was more involved in regulating those emotions, but also planning your actions and your behaviours. And we suggest that interactions between those two networks, where you have a combination of really excessive negative thinking, as well as a poor regulation of those emotions, might make individuals especially vulnerable to suicide acts.
But Dr. Van Harmelen warns that a direct causal connection has not yet been established. She says it could be that people have suicidal thoughts because of these pre-existing brain mechanisms, or it could be the other way round, that stress impacts on the brain mechanisms. She says that the neuroscience is not the sole cause, but that it interacts with social and genetic factors to make people more vulnerable. But she hopes that this research leads to a greater understanding of the problem that will help reduce the stigma of suicidal thinking and lead people to seeking help before it's too late.
Richard Hamilton. In Tanzania, a very proud group of young women have just graduated from school. You might wonder, what's so special about that? Well, it's an amazing feat for the women because they were all teenage mothers who were kicked out of school for being pregnant. Our Africa editor, Mary Harper, has been telling me more about the new graduates.
The women who've graduated were schoolgirls who were pregnant. And 2 years ago, the president of Tanzania, John Magufuli, announced that any pregnant schoolgirl was finished. Basically, they should all be expelled from school. So many, many schoolgirls who had found themselves pregnant were thrown out of school. And then this retired teacher, 72-year-old woman who has a school for mothers in the northern town of Arusha, she invited these schoolgirls to go to her school, and she has a creche there, so they could keep the babies in the creche and they could complete their studies. And now they've graduated.
So she's someone who's dedicated her life to teaching women in that situation?
Yes, since her retirement, that's what she's done. So she has a school where some of the mothers who are a bit older, but then now that these schoolgirls who can no longer attend school, she has provided a space for them and an education.
And in a sense, she's saying to the government, look, it can be done. So have they taken that on board?
The government doesn't, at least the president doesn't appear to have done so. There was an outcry when the president, Magufuli, made this announcement in 2017. And he was basically referring to a law that had been made earlier that pregnant schoolgirls shouldn't be allowed to continue with their education, but it was never really implemented. But he is very draconian. He's introduced all sorts of harsh measures, particularly against the media, against opponents of his government, and also against schoolgirls, when many people really did find that particular move offensive and cruel to the girls. So now there's this great warmth of feeling towards this elderly woman who has set up this school that allows them to complete their education and then carry on and get jobs and have a better life.
Mary Harper. Still to come on the Global News podcast, have you ever considered renting an outfit rather than buying it?
To the renter, it costs about between 10 and 20% of the recommended retail price of the garment. And I think they're saying, well, actually, you know what? I could rent it for £50 and look amazing for the night and also perhaps save the environment a little bit.
We hear about the fashion rental industry, which is now bigger than ever. But first to Madrid, where around 50 presidents and prime ministers are taking part in 2 weeks of UN climate talks amid a growing sense of crisis. Some of the poorer nations are demanding justice because they say they're paying the price for the rich world's carbon emissions. The president of Nauru, Lionel Aynjimea, said small Pacific countries had for years been highlighting the dangers of climate change, but their pleas had fallen on deaf ears.
As a leader of a Pacific Island nation, I am also not so naive as to think appeals to scientific reports will move the most powerful actors in the global economy. It is a political fight, plain and simple. The fact is not lost on a growing climate movement led by our youth around the world. They understand the full implications of the science because they have the most at stake. A younger generation is seizing power in democratic elections and in the streets, and they are demanding climate justice.
The Conference of the Parties, or COP25 as the conference is known, is about taking action, specific commitments by member countries about what they have done up until now and what they will do going forward. But that can often sound quite complicated. So to cut through the jargon, here's an explanation from the BBC's Shivani Dave and Shay Conduct.
What exactly is COP25?
COP stands for the Conference of the Parties, and it's 25 because it's the 25th meeting. It's where nearly 200 member countries meet annually for about 2 weeks to agree a bunch of stuff on how to tackle climate change. It literally determines what the countries are going to do to tackle climate change.
So what's on the agenda?
You'll hear a lot of people talking about the Paris Agreement.
Wait, what's that again?
Back in 2015, almost 200 countries agreed to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees above average pre-industrial temperatures. So a quick recap on that. Average global temperatures have been rising because we started burning coal and other fossil fuels on a big scale about 200 years ago, releasing loads of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Not only that, it's now getting hotter at a faster rate because we're burning more and more. The countries taking part in the Paris Agreement agreed to try to make sure the planet didn't get more than 2 degrees hotter than when this all started.
So what can we expect from the COP?
There's going to be a lot of talk about 1.5 versus 2 degrees. The COP25 will suggest going one step further than the Paris Agreement to make sure global warming is kept below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Scientists have worked out that if we want to keep the global temperature rise under 1.5 degrees, we need to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. That's where we absorb as much carbon dioxide as we emit.
Which countries will and won't step up their climate action game?
In Madrid, we could see some divides between countries about how far they think they should go to cut their carbon emissions. Back in September, at the UN Climate Action Summit in New York, 68 countries indicated they want to do even more. So they took extra measures to close the gap between the current emissions they emit and future aims. But these countries only make up 8% of global emissions.
So who are the countries to look out for?
Lots of people will be watching the world's biggest emitters like the US, China, Brazil, Indonesia and India to see if they step up their efforts at the COP. Also, this could be the last COP for the USA. US diplomats will be among the negotiators, but President Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, meaning it will be officially out of the deal by the end of 2020.
Shivani Dave and Shay Conduct. Well, in East and Southern Africa, many experts believe the effects of climate change are already being felt. The Save the Children charity says that floods, landslides, drought, and cyclones have left at least 1,200 people dead and 33 million at emergency levels of food insecurity. Kenya has been particularly hard hit, as Emmanuel Igunza explains in this report from Nairobi.
Kenya seems to have borne the brunt of the weekend's weather. At least 3 people were killed by floods in the east of the country. Dramatic footage emerged of a man being rescued by a police helicopter after 2 days stranded on a patch of land surrounded by raging waters. Dozens of villagers held vigils on the other side of the bank, some even attempting to throw him food. But it was only on Sunday the police chopper got to him.
I had gone to the river to fish on Friday when the flood waters came in suddenly. There was no sign of floods earlier. Within seconds, water was everywhere and I could not cross the river. It's been terrible being stranded here in the cold and rain. I was hungry and went through a lot. There were so many mosquitoes and I was afraid of animals like crocodiles and hippos. But I am so happy and feel well after such a dramatic rescue. I feel like I am reborn again.
Entire villages in western, eastern and central Kenya have been destroyed by floods and landslides, forcing emergency services to evacuate people to safer grounds. The government says at least 120 people have died in the country since the onset of rains in October. In neighboring Tanzania, 7 people are killed in different districts in the northeast following severe flooding. Extreme weather has also affected Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, Somalia, Sudan and South Sudan, where tens of thousands of people have lost their homes and livelihoods. Weather experts say the rains are caused by a phenomenon called the Indian Ocean Dipole, where a 2-degree rise in water temperatures causes high evaporation of the East African coastline. The water then falls inland.
Emmanuel Igunza. President Trump has arrived in Britain for a NATO gathering which begins in London today. Mr. Trump is due to meet the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, and will hold talks with Prime Minister Boris Johnson before visiting Buckingham Palace for a reception with the Queen. NATO, which was founded 70 years ago, has been described by advocates as the most successful military alliance in history. But just last month, French President Emmanuel Macron said it was brain dead, and the alliance itself is being strangely low-key about this week's brief meeting, refusing to call it a summit. Our diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus reflects on NATO and considers its future.
Most NATO governments are strong supporters of the alliance. They believe that it should continue. They believe that that transatlantic tie is important. The difficulty is, of course, that as the alliance gets so much bigger, it's now 29, soon will be 30 members, it becomes less agile, less able to make decisions quickly and so on. And you also have, I think, a problem of very different perceptions in different parts of the alliance. And indeed, you know, making a BBC radio programme recently on the future of the NATO alliance, you know, one very eminent commentator here in Britain said, you know, the paradox is that the alliance is today twice as large as it ever used to be, but it's probably only half as strong.
Jonathan Marcus, with Christmas approaching, many will be shopping for a special outfit to wear to office parties or family get-togethers. But have you ever considered renting an outfit instead? As Peter Goffin reports, it's a sustainable option that can save you a fair bit of money.
So you've got that Christmas party coming up, or a wedding, or a night out, and you need something to wear that won't cost a fortune. You can go to the high street and buy an outfit you'll only use once or twice, or, for the same price, maybe even less, you can rent one. It's not a new idea. Think of all the men who've rented tuxedos over the years. But with the help of new online platforms and subscription services, the fashion rental industry is bigger than ever. Part of the so-called digital sharing economy, driven by the likes of Airbnb and Uber. Rent the Runway, a company in the US, has been valued at $1 billion. And here in the UK, Jane Shepherdson, a former executive for the major retailers Topshop and Whistles, has signed on as chair of My Wardrobe, a website that helps you rent women's clothing from brands or private owners. Ms. Shepherdson told the BBC it's both cost-effective and ecologically friendly.
To the renter, it costs about between 10 and 20% of the recommended retail price of the garment. And I think they're saying, well, actually, you know what, I could rent it for £50 and look amazing for the night and also perhaps save the environment a little bit.
Over the past decade, the retail market has been dominated by fast fashion outlets selling cheap, easily worn out pieces that consumers can wear a few times and then throw away. To meet the demand, manufacturers churn out immense amounts of clothing, much of which gets burned or sent to the landfill when it fails to sell. It's a system that creates an incredible amount of waste. The fashion industry is a major source of greenhouse gases linked to climate change, and Britain's Institution of Mechanical Engineers has said more than a third of the microplastics polluting the world's oceans come from synthetic fabrics in discarded clothing. So there's a growing number of consumers who say renting clothes is the responsible option. They're turning their backs on disposable fashion and trying to keep clothes out of the rubbish heap.
Peter Goffin. Roger Federer has won many awards and accolades during his career, but now the tennis star is to receive a slightly different honor, one never before given to a living person in his native Switzerland. The 20-time Grand Slam champion is to be commemorated on coins in Switzerland. Imogen Folks is in Geneva and can tell us more.
Roger Federer has won more men's Grand Slam titles than anyone else. In his native Switzerland, he is revered not just for his tennis skills and his ability to continue playing long after others might have retired, but for what Swissmint, announcing the commemorative coin, described as his likability, down-to-earthness and eloquence. When he won the Australian Open in 2017, during the height of the Swiss ski season, the slopes were empty. The entire country was inside watching the match. Way back in 2007, Roger Federer was commemorated on a stamp. Now he will have a coin bearing his image too. Both are likely to become collector's items.
Imogen Folks. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.